Members, I call the committee to order. And we have several things we want to get through today. Let's start off by adopting a couple, a set of minutes. And Representative Dean, would you be so kind as to move the March 5th minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Very well. March 5th minutes have been moved. Discussion. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The March 5th minutes are adopted. And Representative Edelson, you have a motion in regards to the March 4th minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I would like to amend the minutes. It says Representative Nash requested that House Bill 2709 be laid over. It's actually laid on the table and requested a roll call.
All right, so that's on, page 3 or something like that?
Page 2, Chair.
And it's House File what now?
House File 2709.
2709. So Representative Edelson moves adoption of the March 4th minutes with the oral amendment to do again what, Representative Edelson?
Be laid on the table.
Be laid on the table in lieu of to be laid over?
Yes, correct. Okay.
All right. Discussion. All in favor of the motion to adopt the minutes with the oral amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Thank you, members.
Thanks. Oh, here you go.
Yes. Okay. Very well. Members, we're going to start with House File 4049, Representative Tapke from our sister or brother committee of corrections. The chair will move House File 4049 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. Representative Tapke. Might as well address this issue right now. Yeah, and members, there is an amendment to this, the A20 amendment. I'm not going to move that amendment right now in a conversation with our minority leaders. This motion of successful will be going on to the Transportation Committee, and we can certainly amend it at that time. It's a very technical amendment, members, and we even have the unusual notice from our Deputy Revisor, Ms. Karen Letterts, explaining the error in drafting this explaining why this is really truly just a technical amendment. Members, if we were going to the floor, Representative Johnson and I spoke, we probably would just go ahead and do this technical amendment now. But since we've got another stop in transportation, we can do it at that point. But I just want to make sure that the interest of stakeholders, in particular the department, understands what the intention is of Representative Dapke and certainly of this chair and this committee. Relative to the A20-0663 amendment. And so again, assuming that this bill moves forward, Representative Dapke, I would certainly hope that you're having the A20 amendment moved in transportation. Very well. With that, then let's begin testimony on the bill. Representative Dapke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is House File 4049. This is a Department of Corrections agency bill. And so with this bill simply authorizes the Department of Vehicle Services to accept an ID issued by the Department of Corrections or the Federal Bureau of Prisons as a secondary form of documentation for the purposes of securing a state identification card or a driver's license. The person would still need to supply an ID from a list of primary documents, such as a birth certificate, passport, etc., and this bill does not create any new forms of identifications. The Department of Corrections and BOP already issue IDs to inmates for use during incarceration, and this bill allows an ID issued by a state or federal government entity, such as the Department of Corrections or BOP, to be accepted as a secondary document. So as you know, 95% of those who are incarcerated in our state prisons will be re-entering our communities. And while the DOC has transitions coordinators at its facilities who work with those incarcerated to obtain the two forms of documentation and then work with our state DVS to to secure a valid state identification card or driver's license, there are many times when we have individuals without any form of IDs coming into prisons for a very short duration of time. And these are the people who are who the transitions coordinators are unable to help secure an ID because they are not with the department for a long enough period to be able to secure a primary form of documentation and a secondary form of document before they are released. These individuals are then leaving these facilities and entering the community without any form of valid ID, and this impacts their ability to be productive members of our society, secure housing, employment, cash checks, and so much more. And so often these individuals also do not have enough money upon release to pay for two forms of documentation and then a state ID card or driver's license on top of that when they are just coming out from prison. And so House File 4049 helps relieve some of this pressure and helps those re-entering our communities be able to secure a valid state identification card. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will hand this over to Deputy Commissioner Curtis Shanklin from the Department of Corrections, if that is all right with you.
Fantastic. Welcome, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Curtis Shanklin. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of our Community Services Division at the Department of Correction. I want to first start off by thanking Representative Tapke for authoring such an important bill for us. Really appreciate that, and also want to thank the members for giving myself and Representative Department of Correction an opportunity to come and testify to this bill. I also want to share that along with me in the audience, I also have the Commissioner, Commissioner Snell, as well as Safia Khan, our Director of Government and Partner Relations. Just in case the pressure gets too hot on me, I can phone a friend and have one of them come up here and sit down, if you all would prefer. Chair and members of the committee, one of the areas that I work and oversee is our reentry unit. As been mentioned, over 95% of the people who we have currently incarcerated will be reentering our communities. Our reentry staff work tirelessly to make sure that we reduce the barriers that these individuals have so that they can actually become productive members of society and continue on an upward trajectory toward contributing to their communities. This past summer, the department spoke with our partners who have recently reentered community and those who are working with individuals who are also reentering the community. This included folks from halfway houses, the legal community, and others. We wanted to know what are the greatest barriers that our currently incarcerated people face as they start their reentry process back into the community. While a lack of housing options, employment, treatment, and other services repeatedly came up in those conversations, it's important to note that one of the greatest barriers that they face was identified as the lack of the ability to secure a valid identification card. Chair and members, as you all know, an ID card is absolutely vital to participating in society in a meaningful way. We need an ID to do just about anything, to start a job, to secure housing, to get medication, and even to cash our checks. As the former U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch wrote on this issue of the maze of formerly incarcerated individuals and how they have to navigate in her essay called The Elusiveness of an Official ID After Prison, she stated, a flat piece of plastic can mean so much to a former inmate. It can mean stable housing, a better job, access to social services, educational opportunities, and more. But this singular piece of plastic proves elusive, impossible really, for scores of citizens across the United States. Indeed, in listening to those who are left at our facilities without any form of identification, we have heard about the impact that this has had on their ability to do anything productive as they start their transition back into the community. We have heard from and of individuals who have had jobs and housing lined up but could not secure them due to not having valid identification. House File 4049 does not change who is eligible for a state identification card. It simply makes an ID issued by the Department of Corrections or the Federal Bureau of Prisons an eligible secondary document for the purposes of securing an ID by the Department of Vehicular Services. As you can see from the handout that was passed around, to obtain a state identification card, you need two forms of documentation. One from the list of a primary form of identification, as well as the list of a secondary form of identification. Often paying for these three different documents, The two identification documents and the state ID itself can be very challenging for those who we serve and are reentering back into our communities. If this bill passes, individuals benefiting from it will need to produce a primary form of documentation along with their prison ID. The prison ID will simply count as a secondary document. Chair and members, you can see from the list of other secondary documents that my own department-issued employee ID here would qualify as a secondary identification. And that would be the one that I'm actually wearing right here, that this ID right here would qualify as a secondary form of identification. So would school IDs for our children who are in secondary school, and so would documents like a certified secondary or post-secondary school transcript containing someone's legal full name and date of birth, or a certified marriage certificate. To give you a better picture of how common in practice this is, at least 22 other states have departments of motor vehicles that accept some form of the Department of Corrections documentation as proof of identity. Moreover, implementing this bill would not be very onerous or costly. Internally, it would require only a policy change to ensure that those who do not have a valid ID in their possession when they leave a facility, generated identification card when they turn in with a primary document to the DVS to obtain an identification card. We currently already issue IDs to every person in our state prisons for the duration of their incarceration, but since they are not currently acceptable by the DVS, it is not an ID they leave our facilities with. We can easily update the IDs to include the information criteria under this bill, such as the date of birth, etc., to give those who have no IDs when they are leaving our facilities. In terms of cost, there is not one to the Department of Corrections alone. In addition to what we already do, in speaking with our partners at the Department of Public Safety, there would be a one-time cost of $16,000 to them to update their program to accept these IDs. We currently have a designated fund for our reentry services that we use to fund our reentry services, including paying for one ID for those who don't have one. We have a current contract with DVS, and they come into our facilities to process these IDs for those who are in queue to be released. We will use this designated fund to pay the one-time cost of $16,000 to DPS through an interagency transfer to accept our IDs into their system. So there is no cost to the general fund, and the DOC is not asking for any money for this bill. Chair and members, this bill means a lot to my division's work to ensure those reentering are able to reintegrate into society. It is simply a solution, and though it will not help all the issues, it will certainly be a form of relief for countless individuals reentering our communities. It is in all of our best interest that we are able to have valid IDs that we can assure them jobs, housing, and access to other services that are critical to their smooth transition. I will also want to note is that we constantly see, and I can attest to, that Minnesota ranks toward the top as one of the top places in the country to both work and live. As me being a Southern boy at heart from Mississippi, I can attest after undergraduate, I decided to stay here in Minnesota. However, with that being said, we also know that in our state prisons here in Minnesota, we have some of the worst and significant racial disparities. We also see those disparities when we look at socioeconomic status for our people of color and our Native American and American Indian people around the state. So when we have our people of color and Native American folks who are looking to reenter into their communities, who are already facing inequities and disparities as it pertains to their socioeconomic status, this bill will help with the relief of those who are continuing to try to transition into their community safely and become productive members of society. I truly thank you for your time and consideration, and will be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, or again, I might defer those to the other two sitting in the audience. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for making a very compelling case. Representative Tapke, you have another testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we do.
Hi.
Welcome.
My name is Chair and members. Thank you for having me. My name is Jamie Rigling, and I was a former Bureau of Prisons employee. I served in the capacity as the Reentry Affairs Coordinator for 9 years. During my tenure there, I worked with all the prisons in Minnesota to include the states. I'm not sure if everyone knows, we have 4 federal prisons inside Minnesota. We have a prison in Duluth, we have a prison in Sandstone, Rochester, Minnesota, and a women's facility in Waseca, Minnesota. The state of Minnesota houses over 3,000 inmates federally. We have 121 prisons across the nation, and constantly we're sending people back into the community without identification. So as I sit here before you today, I just want to encourage you that your support to help my clients. Let me just say now, I work for the United States Court District. I'm the Community Intervention Administrator. So for those people that I failed to get identification for in the federal prison, I'm now on the probation side of it, trying to help them get identification on a daily basis. So this would really, really help them get employment, get access to housing, and also save taxpayers money, because while we are here today, I have several of them not working. So in the name of social justice, by not allowing them to have their identity, it hurts their entire society. It drains unnecessary resources for those that might be temporarily and permanently disabled. So I encourage you to I urge you to support this important legislation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Ringling. So it's good to hear the similar desire and hope on the part of our federal Bureau of Prisons. Representative, I'm going to open this up to questions quickly, but I'll start. Representative Tapke, and it could be for either one of our testifiers, I imagine. The identification card, we're prescribing the obvious, that there'd be full name, date of birth, photograph, and an expiration date. What is the expiration date? Is it a year? Is it 2 years? Is that standard? Are they similar between the federal and the DLC issued cards?
So for us, for the Bureau of Prisons, it would be their projected release date, most likely, because most of our clients come back into the community and they're serving at a halfway house. So they may have 30 days past their release date and go to the halfway house.
Deputy Commissioner? And Chair, members of the committee, it would be at the expiration of their sentence for us at the Department of Corrections.
Very well. We have 2 questions, Representative Nash and then Representative Considine. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions that I have. Both Representative Lucero and I work in cybersecurity, and that's one of the questions that I've got is you're going to be collecting additional information than you already have, I believe. And if not, then the ID is not going to be as comprehensive as other forms of ID. You did say that you're going to be collecting date of birth. What other data elements are you going to be collecting on this state ID, on this ID?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair, members of the committee, it will be their date of birth, their full name, as listed on there. I believe it's their expiration date, but let me confirm that with. Yeah, I was correct. It's just those things, and those things are already captured on their current identification cards that we issue.
Okay, and Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, as you do these IDs, is it going to be compliant with other regulations around IDs? Is it going to be, are they going to be manufactured in the ways that, say, a driver's license or the real ID driver's license is going to be manufactured? My concern is, and you've already said this, they're not going to be leaving with this. I think you hope to change that, but they're not currently doing that. The information is somewhat scant, but I'm also interested, where is this data going to be warehoused? Because knowing the state and cybersecurity like I do, you guys have had a couple of breaches and a couple of ransom attacks. I'd like to know a little bit more about the fiscal costs that you're going to incur to defend this data that you're going to be warehousing now.
And Deputy Commissioner, per your testimony earlier, I just want to make sure I'm tracking along with Representative Nash's question. You're currently collecting this data, and you're currently issuing IDs. The issue here really has to do, question before us, is the acceptance of those relative to a couple functions. Looks like primarily over at DVS. I'm just trying to, shorten up the response.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Representative Nash, to your first question, the former question that you had, as I kind of alluded to in the testimony, we already have the DB that comes into the facilities to process the identification cards. That one-time cost that I mentioned, the $16,000, would be for that transfer over to the DPS system where they already collect this data, they capture it, and they hold that data there. And I also just want to point out that, again, this does meet this will be aligned with 22 other states that have done this. And I will stress again, this is just the secondary form of identification. They would still need to present their primary form of identification. This would just allow this identification card to count as the secondary form of identification for those who are reentering back into the community.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess my question is, and maybe I misheard your testimony, but you were saying that this secondary ID card is going to help them cash checks and obtain other things, because maybe I heard your testimony wrong, but that's what I heard, and I'm just trying to figure out this, if this doesn't meet the scrutiny of I'll wait. If this doesn't meet the scrutiny as other IDs that are valid for those things, what's the purpose in this? Because I'm failing to see that.
Deputy Commissioner, my understanding is that as a secondary ID, what this is going to allow them to do is to obtain a state ID under which they could do things like cash a check. Is that correct?
Chair, Representative Nash, yes, that is correct. When I spoke about the testimony, it was talking about that actually being able to cash checks is just one of the issues that many of us face, and the reason why having an identification card is so important for all of us. And again, this will just allow them to be able to obtain the proper identification, as the chair just laid out, so that they could get the their primary identification card that would allow them to then cash checks and other means that they need to do with their primary identification card. This would just be the mechanism for them to be able to obtain a primary identification card.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash, we have two other folks.
I understand that, Mr. Chair, but I still have questions that have not been answered, so I'd kind of like to go down the road of getting them answered.
Representative Nash, I will come back to you after I ask your colleagues. They have an opportunity to ask questions. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a great bill, in part because of its simplicity. Provide an ID card when they're walking out the door. I used to make them. Statute of limitations, I'm probably over on that. But I would get their booking photo. I would get their charge sheet when they came in. I'd put them on the make a copy together. And they would have something to go out the door with, and frankly, people did take them for cashing checks and using them for second ID, but they were desperate because they had nothing. My one question, I guess, would be, is it possible to offer this service to the county jails? Because I was working in a county jail at the time when I was making fake IDs. So.
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair, if you're okay, I'm going to have our Director of Government and Partner Relations sit in my seat.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Khan.
Chair and members, thank you for having me. Chair, we have not had conversations with our partners at the Sheriff's Association. We can certainly touch base with them and see if they issue such IDs and if there is a need. So certainly we'd be open to adding that to our bill.
Real quickly, no, they don't. And again, I had so many clients that were walking out the door with in a desperate situation to try to, cash even the check that they were getting from the county jail that that's what got me started on making these with the booking photos.
Chair, members, the legislation does not actually authorize us to create the IDs. We already do that. We have the IDs already. The whole purpose of this is for them to be able to walk out with something that they can use in conjunction with a primary document for the purpose of getting a state identification card or a driver's license. So that's more of a simpler change.
Thank you.
Very well. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, my first question is for you, Mr. Chair. I was multitasking at the time you asked your very first question. Was your question when these cards expire?
Yeah, I asked, Representative Lucero, I did ask about the expiration dates.
And it was the date that they are discharged? Was that the answer?
We can have the testifiers repeat that answer. Ms. Khan.
Chair, members, the expiration date that we would use would be the end of their sentence. So we have two-thirds of the time they're serving inside, one-third of the time that they're serving outside would be the end of that sentence.
Chair and members, with the Bureau of Prisons, it would be the time that they're in the community correctional system in the halfway house when they're transferred up to, we have two federal halfway houses in Minneapolis. It would be the time that they have their stay there. Some of them have 2 months, some of them have 3, 4, 5, and up to 6 months.
Very well. Thank you, Ms.
Reiner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then on that line of thinking, as I'm scanning the documents, both primary and secondary, not all, but many of them have expiration dates on them. So my question would be, when it comes to somebody's sentence, is there an expiration date on these documents? And then if it includes, if they're on probation and probation changes, how will the expiration date be updated, et cetera, et cetera? Or will these documents, if they don't have an expiration date on them, explicitly stated, does a scenario exist where that document could be valid in perpetuity after the expiration of the sentence because there'd be no way to validate that?
Ms. Khan.
Chair, members, we really carefully worded this bill to include that for DVS to accept that ID, it would have to have an expiration date on it. This would not be an ID that probationers have. It would be people on supervised release or intensive supervised release. So these are people who've come into the prison and then are being released. And they do have a set amount of time that they spend with us as part of their sentence. That sentence is given out by the courts. So when they come in and when we are releasing them, we will know how long they will be on supervision with us during that time. So we'll be able to accurately identify the end of their sentence date and put that on their ID cards.
Last question, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do only have one more question, and that is in regards to Representative Chair Considine. He was talking about how he used to make them. So in the construction of these, I do know that a great deal of effort goes into other forms of document to prevent against fraud or manipulation. So I don't know how these are constructed, but is there the same degree of carefulness to ensure that they can't be manipulated? What is to stop? What are the fraud protections, if you could enumerate that, that would prevent somebody from altering them to use them for ulterior purposes? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. We next have Representative Johnson and members. We do have three other bills.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, that was a question. If they could. I'm curious to know how they're constructed.
Oh, sorry, you were awaiting an answer.
Yeah.
I apologize to you, Representative Lucero, to the testifiers.
Chaired members, for the Federal Bureau of Prisons, we have barcodes on all of ours with their register number and their name, date of birth, and expiration date.
Chair members, I can confirm with our folks at the DOC whether or not we have a barcode, but I know that it mentions their offender ID number currently, which is verifiable to our website as well. So if there was any suspicion that an ID, that the person was not on supervision with us, somebody could just go and check against our website, and that would be information would be available to them. But I can confirm and get that information back to you.
Chair and members, that is also the case for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Thank you for reminding me of that.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Johnson, you're next. And I was just starting to say we have three other bills with testifiers, including on the next bill, someone with from a local law enforcement entity, I believe. And members, I want to be able to honor the fact that folks have come to testify to the bills that we have scheduled here today. So if you can keep that in mind. In terms of brevity and conciseness of the questions and also the answers, I will be appreciative and they will as well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I'm not sure, maybe Representative Tapke can answer this. When, first of all, I was looking through, we got this letter showing the identification requirements. There's 18 primary documents that can be used, and if you actually add them up, they have 12 bullet points, but there's probably about another 16, 17 documents that can be used for secondary identifications besides the 18 primary identifications. So we're going to be adding to that list. But one thing that concerns me on this prison ID, we have a, for those of you who don't know, we have an immigration bill coming to this committee on Thursday. What I'm wondering is, before a state ID is issued, is the state going to be checking immigration status to make sure that they're not here, that they're here legally, and that we're not given a government-issued ID when we should not be?
Chair and members, I can answer that. We have ICE, we have Immigration and Customs come into every Federal Bureau of Prisons before someone is released, and so if they're not allowed to be in the United States, they are taken into Immigration and Customs.
Chair, I'd like to answer that too. Chair members, so the way that we have crafted this bill, it would only be a secondary form of ID. So the person would, again, need something from that primary document list as well. Both forms of IDs are needed for them to be able to go in and get a state identification card or a driver's license.
I appreciate the answer that you are checking, but I'm not sure if you're aware the bill coming up Thursday would ban you from being able to do that.
Very well. Representative Ash, I promise to get back to you, and so I'm circling back. And again, members, I want us to keep moving because we have testifiers on three other bills. Representative Ash.
Well, Mr. Chair, I never did hear an answer to the question about the security measures that were going to be expended to secure this data. And I still have a lot of questions about the manufacturer of the document. And obviously that's going to have a digital copy. I want to make sure that you're exercising proper cybersecurity. And there have been published issues with DOC. And I'm just trying to figure out, you said that there's going to be very little fiscal cost, but when you create data and you have to secure it, you're going to incur a cost. So the idea behind this having a one-time $16,000 appropriation is a misnomer because there's going to be an additional cost to secure that data.
Chair Representative Nash, so we're not collecting any new data. This is data that we already have in our system when we do intake. This is all data that we already collect. Our system is pretty secure. We have certainly had a breach in the fall. I'm happy to have our IT folks come here and talk to you about the way that we capture this data and the security measures that they take to ensure the security of all of this data that is collected. But this is not additional data that we are collecting. We are not assuming any role that DVS plays. We are simply asking for this document to be accepted as a secondary form of documentation for the purposes of DVS issuing a state ID or a driver's license.
Very well, members. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify in this bill, the audience, for or against? If not, Representative Tapke, a few seconds to close this out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a good bill that will help a lot of folks as they are leaving the correctional facility, and I really hope everyone's able to support it.
Very well. Representative Tapke, so the motion is to refer to Transportation Committee. There is an 820 amendment here. I suspect the Transportation Committee may also plow some of the ground that was plowed here today. So my advice is to be prepared for those as you were prepared here today as well. The chair renews his motion that House File 4049 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Tapke, and thank you, Ms. Ringland, and Ms. Kyle. All right, so Representative Tapke, it's good you stuck to your seat there. We have House File 3085, and the motion is to refer this to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Then the chair moves that House File 3085 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, we do have two other bills after this and a few other quicker bills that we want to go through, including a bill from Representative Munson that we've been hanging out to for a little bit too long, and then a couple of bills from... last year as well. If we're not able to get through in the time that's allotted us to today, I will be recessing and reconvening us to finish the work this evening. That breaks my pledge to you not to have another hearing in the evening. However, I leave that to the members and to the testifiers. With that, Representative Tapke, tell us about House File 3085.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 3085 is a bill for transit safety. And as we all know, there have been a variety and multiple issues with people experiencing unsafe situations and concerns on our transit system throughout the metro. And so what this bill does is it creates a six-month pilot program called the Transit Riders Investment Program. And so with this, we are putting together a Transit Rider Investment Program where we will have additional eyes and ears on our light rail system. And so it's a six-month program to learn and figure out how this will work best in our specific transit system throughout the light rail. It's been done in many other, which you'll hear from testimony today, it's been done in this similar type of program, has been very successfully put together in many other jurisdictions across the United States. And so it basically does two things. One, it creates what we're calling Transit Rider Investment Program personnel. And so these will be additional unarmed, uniformed, civil personnel that will be on our light rail trains for a course of 6 months, and we'll be making sure that we are learning from this program and taking these forward so they will be working on the safety and experience of using our light rail system. And so with this, they will be working on de-escalation techniques, making sure to identify problems as they come up, working with different homeless issues that are happening on our light rail, and making sure that we are working together to fix problems that exist today, that we know exist today and that we need. This is just one of a variety of work that is being done by Metro Transit in order to really increase the experience and improve the safety on our light rail from additional police officers and additional ununiformed police officers, as well as live video and a variety of the things that our testifiers will talk about today. So then as well, the other part of this bill does reclassifies fare evasion from a misdemeanor to a petty misdemeanor. So it will go from something that is equitable to a DUI or a DUI or a physical assault to something that is more equitable with a payable fine. And so it makes the fine very much better fit with the crime that is done. So because someone who today is has a $2.50 fare that they have not paid, it's a $180 fine that they receive if they are convicted of not paying their fare. And even so, of all the citations that are given out today, there are less than 3% of those citations that are actually paid because the punishment does not fit the crime. So prosecutors are not prosecuting this this issue. And so we are working to take that from a misdemeanor to a petty misdemeanor as a payable fine. And then also that will be a $35 fine as an the trip personnel will be able to administer those as administrative citations in there as well. And so, Mr. Chair, you guys are not first. We have a couple testifiers. We've got a different order here, so just give me just a second. Come back. We will hear from, if it's all right, Mr. Chair, we'll hear from Met Council first, as well as so Chief Frizzell and Judge Shetton from Met Council are here to talk a little bit more about the bill.
Very well. Thank you, Representative. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony. And you heard the chair's appeal to the entire room, and so brevity would be extremely appreciated.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Judd Shetton, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. We are coming to thank Representative Tapke for carrying this bill. The council has been working with Representative Tapke to really look at how we are finding a way to potentially reclassify the penalty for fare evasion. What this bill does, as Representative Tapke just mentioned, it really helps the penalty fit the crime, and there is no reason why a fare evasion of $2.50 should be considered a misdemeanor. We view it similarly to what a parking ticket would be, and I think people would be very upset if we were going to make a parking ticket a criminal offense. And so we'd like to correct that. We also need the legislature's help to allow us to have someone other than a sworn officer in order to check fares and write an administrative citation for that. We need the legislature's approval to do that. Again, as Representative Tabke mentioned, of the 6,500 interactions we've had, 5,000 of those being warnings, 1,500 of them being citations and tickets that have given out, we've had less than 3% of those end up being paid. And I think the best argument for why they aren't being paid is because they're not being prosecuted, because prosecutors don't want to make criminals out of folks that are being having a fare evasion on their ticket. What this would allow us to do is to lean into enforcement, make sure that people are paying their fares, and it would allow someone other than a sworn officer to be able to do that. So we need your help in order to do that. With me is Chief Frizzell from Metro Transit, and I'll have him make a couple words. And Chief is one of the folks that has to get out of here, so I appreciate you allowing us to jump in line here.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Eddie Frizzell, Chief of Police, Metro Transit Police Department. And I would just briefly say, as we start to look through this bill, as we have a multi-pronged approach to safety and security on our systems. For those that are not familiar with what Metro Transit Police actually do, we have a 7-county, 85-community jurisdiction. We have law enforcement responsibilities on all the light rails, trains, and buses that run throughout the region. So it's a very large footprint. As we stand today, we have 141 officers that have the potential contact of over 270,000 people a day. That's nearly 84 million people a year. So our responsibilities are great and broad, and we want to use as much influence as we can to help form partnerships, not only with the electeds, but other municipalities, as well as the communities in which we serve.
Very well. Thank you, Chief. You know, and I had a conversation with Hennepin County Sheriff Hutchinson last week, I think it was, and he shared with me the ways in which your department is also coordinating with his, with other local traditional law enforcement entities. It sure looks like part of this bill is about adding more eyes, eyes, ears, and bodies to be present on our LRT systems. And it sounds like that's all our transit systems. It sounds like that's a welcome, that would be a welcome addition from your perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. With that, we have questions. Representative Otten.
Mr. Chair, I have a...
I'm sorry. You had other testifiers.
A couple more testifiers,
yes.
We'll go very, very quickly.
I apologize. Come on forward, please.
Thank you.
It's okay, Chief.
Yeah.
And Chief, if you do need to scoot, we certainly understand.
Mr. Chair, we have Farji Shahir here to discuss the community impact and public safety aspects of the bill.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Farji Shahir. Thank you, Chair and members of the chair. My name is Farji Shahir. I'm a violence intervention specialist and also a 20-year employee of Hennepin County Medical Center's Acute Psychiatric Services. So I'm also a mental health professional and a firm believer that in order to change some of the scenarios surrounding gun violence and violence in our areas, you have to employ individuals who are familiar with the situations and know how to use tactics to de-escalate situations as they're occurring. By being a part of the violence intervention programs, I'm also working at Hennepin County Medical Center and also North Memorial. So every time that there is a shooting throughout the Twin Cities area, my team is dispatched in order to kind of figure out what's going on the ground and then try to get the individuals that we meet to change their lives. So pretty much I support this bill because there are multiple individuals that actually come into the hospital who have been injured or assaulted or robbed and things of that nature. And I also believe that this bill will allow us to have individuals who are actively trying to change their communities more involved and more engaged and willing to spend time in areas where they normally wouldn't spend their lives. The individuals that use the light rail are individuals that are trying to get to and from Minneapolis to St. Paul. Some of them are dealing with, you know, poverty. Some of them are intoxicated. Some of them are suffering from mental illness. And while dealing with these multiple stressors on the light rail system or Metro Transit systems, it really doesn't take that much to trigger individuals who are possibly intoxicated and also suffering from mental illness and at the same time are not able to really afford their fare. With those triggers, these individuals could possibly react out in violent ways that will not respond to other individuals the way they would if you had members like myself or members like these gentlemen actually actively riding on the trains. What I've seen in the last 4 years is that most of the individuals that we encounter who are violent are actually looking for some form of guidance or some form of support to help them deal with the situations that they're dealing with. And with the background of having crisis intervention training and knowing how to verbally de-escalate violent situations where individuals are carrying guns and knives, we are able to actually obtain, in some cases, the firearms and the knives that these individuals were planning on using just by acknowledging them as being human beings and understanding that they are making some form of mistake. And normally, in these situations, we are able to calm people down so that they start moving in the right direction. Ultimately, the goal would be to make sure that the Metro Transit lines and the buses remain safe so that individuals can actually get to and from work or malls or baseball games. Specifically, there are high peak times when children are getting off of school or when there are events going on downtown when we see these increases of violence, increases of robberies and assaults. And those would be the times where I believe the team that is dispatched from the communities in which these incidents are occurring will be most effective in reducing some of those crimes. I also believe that the use of transportation should be safe for all members of the community from all walks of life, because we do have individuals that go to work in the morning at 7 a.m. and sometimes are met with individuals that have absolutely nowhere to go. So these individuals will cross paths at multiple levels of their lives during the course of a day, and we would like to make sure that all of the individuals remain safe. We will be able to provide some form of training to individuals that are interested in becoming part of this bill or part of the staff that will be facilitating those rides. We want to be able to train them in verbal de-escalation and also crisis intervention, because we not only want to stop situations, but we also want to provide resources for individuals that may need those resources. A $2 token is definitely something that we should be able to provide for individuals that do not have the means to get on the bus legally instead of finding them the $180-some-odd. That's pretty much all I want.
Thank you, Mr. Shahir, for your testimony, and more importantly, thank you for the work that you do out in the public, be part of helping to keep us all safe.
Sir.
Greatly appreciate it. Welcome to the committee, sir.
My name is Tiger Menz. I'm from the east side of St. Paul, born and raised. I run Black Lives Matter. And this is one thing that we want to bolster up through One Family, One Community, is where we just simply do the outreach. We do the work as far as helping train, giving from our hindsight as to what we know is effective. And so we're here to just support it at the first round. We want to definitely continue to see this bill go, because it does add that equity piece when you really want to help solve these problems that we're experiencing. You're dealing with peers on the ground. So that's it's very simple, and we definitely hope for support from the community and this committee as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And again, give me your last name, sir. I'm sorry.
Todd Gremenz.
Gremenz.
Yeah, Gremenz.
Very well. All right, Representative Tapke, I think we're open for questions then.
We have, we can move on to questions if you like, but Mr. Wilshore from East Metro Strong has, it's up to you, Mr. Chair. If we need to move on, we can move on.
I would rather move on.
Okay.
But I also don't want to tell the public can't testify. We have two other bills I want to act on.
Yep, we can absolutely send this out. They were going to, from Minneapolis and St. Paul, downtown improvement districts, to talk about how important the collaboration between between the police departments as well as the ambassador programs are for really incredibly improving the safety of our communities.
It does seem to be critically important that the whole community pulls together and coordinates across different sectors.
Absolutely.
Very well. We do have a series of members. Members, I'm going to ask you to ask one question. If you have two, I'll circle back to you. But I want to make sure that we're respectful of each one of our colleagues so that they have the opportunity to ask a question. I'll begin with Representative Otney.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Got a question for Chief Frizzell.
Is the chief still here?
Or in his place? I forgot your name, sir.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Judd Shetton, the Government Affairs Director. Chief apologizes, but he had to leave. He's got a prior engagement that he had to make out in Brooklyn Center.
I think you initially testified to the issue thing. And I realize that my hearing isn't what it used to be, and my wife tells me I need hearing aids. But to me, it sounded like you said out of all of the tickets that you do issue, you only receive 3% of those paid. So out of the last year that you had, 2018 was the last complete year of numbers that I could find, you had a total of 5,242 contacts for fare evasion. Out of that, you only issued 783 citations, and out of that, only 157 paid.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that can break down the numbers. Like, so we had 5,000 warnings that were provided. There were 1,500 tickets that were written. And of those 1,500, we had about 45 fines that were paid, or about 3% of the actual citations.
I'm sorry, Chair Mariani, 45?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. And I would like to point out that the Met Council Metro Transit does not have a prosecuting attorney. We do not do these prosecutions. We turn them over to the counties. The counties make a determination on whether or not they want to bring this forward. That is one of the main reasons why we are here supporting those aspects of Representative Tabke's bill, because we're trying to reclassify the penalty from a criminal penalty to an administrative citation or petty misdemeanor, so that the penalty fits the offense. And we think that is smart. It's just similar to, as I mentioned earlier, if a parking ticket currently is a petty misdemeanor or a citation like that, we are trying to make our fare evasion similar to that versus making a parking ticket basically a criminal offense. It's they work together like that.
Quick follow-up, Chair. Representative Johnson, Representative Navani, if you wish, I can't come back to you. But again, I want to make sure everyone gets their questions. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I don't know where to begin with just one question. There's a lot of issues here. Representative Novotny had a good point, and with his point, if the prosecutors and the city are only collecting 3% or even going after 3%, maybe the city should be paying for this program instead of the state if they're not doing their duties. They also mentioned about de-escalation tactics. Law enforcement has been using them long before they're even called that. But de-escalation tactics are a two-way street. The other party has to cooperate, and a lot of times they don't. We do our best. But my concern that I have a question about is on the employment status. It's temporary. I'm looking at the numbers. For 12 months of a manager, $160,000. For 7 months of a supervisor, $140,000, which equates to over $220,000 a year for a supervisor. 12 months of a data analyst, for two data analysts, it's only a little over $60,000 apiece. I'm wondering why the managers and supervisors are getting so much more, since the data analysts do all the work. But they're all classified as temporary employees. Now, once this pilot program is done, Who's going to be, has the cost of the unemployment payments that the state has to do been entered into this fiscal note and those costs being taken care of? Because they're temporary employees with worked 6 months, 6 months to a year. You're going to have to pay unemployment on them once they are no longer employed.
Representative Papke, we may also want to draw in our fiscal staff, but perhaps we'll just start with you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson and members. This bill originally began as a full program, and so as to having pushing to make sure that we got started. However, with the fiscal aspect of it, make it the ambassador program and the really important things that we want to get into practice as soon as possible were unable to happen for another 18 months or so. And so with that, we worked really hard with a lot of different folks to make sure that we are able to recognize the urgency and the need for getting this moving forward now, and understanding that many other programs have started this type of program off with a pilot project. And so we learned from what other people have done. And so we're starting this with a six-month pilot project. Met Council would prefer to start it with a full-fledged program, but right now we're starting with a six-month pilot project to get it funded and started up today, because we know that we have issues and concerns out there today, and I don't think it's the right thing to do to wait until things can be fully funded in the next biennium to make this happen and protect folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the gentleman from the Met Council. We heard how many warnings were given. We heard about the actual tickets that were given out and the 3% that actually paid for their ticket. My question kind of goes along with this, and I'd like to know how many people that ride the light rail actually buy a ticket.
Mr.
Chair and members, that is a very good question. I appreciate you asking it. We are assuming that currently right now on the rail lines that we have fare compliance of about 80 to 85%. And so we are updating those numbers right now, but we are in the process we realize that there is some fare evasion that's going on. One of the things that this bill will allow us to do is to have someone other than a sworn officer be able to do that. I think the questions that you raise about the cost of this program, all of those are good. We're trying to find a way to do this with non-sworn officers, but also like in the type of a community service officer type person who would be able to do those aspects of the bill that Representative Tapke has, but also the fare evasion checks, which is what we are interested in having the legislature allow us to do, because we do know that if we were to do that through a sworn officer and try to deploy more folks out there to do that, that cost would be much higher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're good. Very well. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for bringing this bill forward. I just want to comment that from my friends across the aisle, it seems like we've heard a lot this session about concerns about safety on the light rail, and here we have a proposal to do something about it if the status quo isn't working. I appreciate the fact that we have a bill before us that can start to do something about this. And my question is for Representative Habke, for the testifier, this model that you're talking about, you know, having more eyes and ears on the train, it makes a ton of sense. Is it informed by what we've seen in other regions, other states?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Howard. Yes, that is what Mr. Schroer's testimony was going to discuss. And I'll make sure to get that if it's not in your – I believe the PowerPoint is in your packets. There's a lot of really great information in there about what other communities are doing and how this has worked and really influenced and become great partners with the sworn officers and peace officers in many communities across the United States to really improve safety, because we know for a fact that we can and do improve safety when we have more presence and more relationships built between people who are using our transit system and our sworn officers and civil members. In this case, it would be the trip personnel. And so we know that that makes a difference, and we know that that will help improve both the safety and experience of using our transit system.
Mr. Chair, if I can add one piece to that. And Chief Frizzell may have said this, but one thing I want to make sure that the committee understands is the council is taking, and Metro Transit are taking steps in order to address this. We're in the process now of putting live cameras on all of our trains. We currently have them on the platforms. So that is a force multiplier for us, which we appreciate. We're able to see what's going on, be able to react in real time if something is happening. So that is that's something that we're able to do. However, we're not able to reclassify the penalty. We're not able to have someone other than a sworn officer write a ticket. So that's why we're here talking to all of you to seek your help in order to do that, because we have taken steps in order to do the things that we can do within our statutory boundaries in order to take a different approach, because we know that the current approach clearly isn't working, and we'll be the first to admit it. It isn't working, but we need your help to find that alternative, and I would appreciate your support for that.
Very well, thank you. And I do note in the handout there's several cities here spread out across the country: Buffalo, Dallas, Denver, Seattle, Portland, San Diego, et cetera. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I work outside the legislature with Metro Transit Police all the time. This is on felony offenses, so it wouldn't be charging the cases we're talking about, the misdemeanor fare evasion. And I don't know how somebody could argue this wouldn't enhance public safety when you got more eyes and ears, and the cops that I'm working with then can focus on public safety crimes. And I guess that's where it feels like the better comparison. I just want to get a comment on this, is not with parking tickets, but actually with speeding tickets. Because speeding tickets get a petty misdemeanor, and that's threatening to public safety in a way that fare evasion certainly isn't. So I don't understand why we would possibly leave fare evasion a misdemeanor. So can you just comment on the comparison to speeding tickets? Because that seems like a better comparison to me than parking tickets you referenced.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's a very good comparison, and I will start using that one now.
glad to be helpful. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was just returning from speaking at another event, so I apologize for missing the opening testimony. But as I walked in, I heard the testifier say they are either looking to expand or are currently using cameras in trains, on trains, or on the platforms. And the thing that's very concerning to me and actually frustrates me to some degree is cameras being thought of as the panacea for security. And that's what's frustrating. The thing that concerns me is we had a conversation in the Data Practices and Personal Data Privacy Commission just a few, maybe a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, in the use of government cameras specifically on transit vehicles and the transit system, because they can contain microphones that can pick up conversations between what two parties believe is a private conversation. And then that information from these cameras, both audio and visual, is being captured, potentially stored. Who is hearing these conversations? Does a person believe that they or have an expectation of privacy? And so, again, it raises a whole host of questions, which I won't get into now, but it's very alarming and concerning and frustrating when we look to cameras, when there are other proven methods to deter crime that is certainly increasing in the transit system. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Of course, cameras are not part of this bill, and so I don't want to go into that at this point. We can certainly have a conversation. It, quite frankly, it sounds like we should, both here and in judiciary with data relative to some of the issues that you raise. I think they're not insignificant, and so I appreciate you raising those. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at the fiscal note, and I have a couple questions about it, but first I wanted to just kind of bring to light a couple things. So they've got both a headcount and FTE count, which is slightly different, but of the total 14 people, which account for 10 FTEs, I found it interesting, I'll just say. So out of the people that are actually be riding the trains, it's 10 people, but it's essentially 6.5 FTE, so I'm assuming they're part-time. There's one project manager, that's a one FTE, one supervisor, just a little over half an FTE, two data analysts. So out of the 14 people, six and 10 FTEs, six of the FTEs are actually on the trains, and the rest of the FTEs are managers, supervisors, data analysts. I just wanted to point that out. And then if you look at the cost, one supervisor cost is $140,000 per year. $140,000. The manager is $160,000 per year. That's pretty high, I think. But, you know, it's sort of been presented like, oh, we're going to put more people on the trains. But, and you are. But you're also adding a manager, a supervisor, and two data analysts. So I think the public should know that there's more than just 10 bodies that are going to be on the trains. My question is, why do we have two data analysts in this fiscal note? What are they doing?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, so we got this. So the way we got to the, basically, we decided to appropriate $1 million for this project, and we worked through that through the previous bill that we had in the fiscal note and what we had intended to get at. This fiscal note came through, and the first that I saw this data was last night. So I have not had the chance to work with Met Council to say exactly what is the intent of having these, because we don't necessarily have all of the legislative intent for those. So we have to work through those questions yet, and we have to work through those questions on our way, hopefully, to Ways and Means to make sure that this intent from Met Council is meeting the intent from our bill. And Mr. Chetnin may have something else to add to that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members, I can actually speak to that. The data analysts that you're seeing there are actually folks that are developing the program. In there it says that we have to basically develop this administrative citations program. That is the duties of those data analysts. But the way that the fiscal note was put together, it was just basically a comparison to a similar job that we have at Metro Transit. So that's where we received those numbers. Since they don't exist, we were trying to figure out what the correct class of those people who would be developing that program came from. So it's we had to reach somewhere to find that comparison, and that's where you're finding it. And Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, I'd be happy to have our folks sit down and explain how they developed this fiscal note. I will say, and Representative Tabke mentioned this earlier, that we would like to see this program, you know, begin and be a larger program right out of the chute. Obviously, Representative Tabke is working this through the House here and having to make it fit their parameters. And so, and we appreciate all of those hurdles that have to take place as well. But we would like to see the program a bit bigger and focused on the fare evasion.
Mr. Chair, may I have a follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to be clear from this fiscal note that we're paying supervisors and managers, not actually people to ride the train, over $300,000 in this pilot. That just seems like an awful lot, just kind of putting it out there. And out of the 10 FTEs, six of them are actually going to be riding the train. So, you know, there's a whole lot of managerial and program stuff in here that's not really people riding the train. So I just thought the public should know that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, I would say that what the bill does require is for us to develop a program to create the kind of internal court system for a administrative citation. So we're starting from scratch. So it isn't our intention isn't to make that department bigger. Purpose here is to get that additional safety eyes and ears out on the trains, but we have to actually create the program from scratch and put it into effect. So I don't want folks to have the takeaway that we're trying to really build the administrative side, like the work administrative side of this. We are basically having to create a system, and that is where you're finding that. And I am sincere that I would love to have the opportunity to sit down with our folks and explain this, because I think it's really important.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, one last comment. Now, am I understanding that, maybe a question. Am I understanding this pilot project is a six-month project, so it's $1 million for 6 months, And of that, it's over 300,000 for administrative people, like two supervisor and, you know, two supervisory people. Is that, am I reading this right?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, yes, this is starting up a 6-month pilot program that we absolutely hope is something that will continue on in the future because it's necessary and critical for our future and making sure that we are continuing to enhance the experience and safety of using our transit system. So you are absolutely correct on that.
Okay. Very well. Members, the chair is going to lay this bill over because there are still questions that are remaining. My intent would be to bring this back later today. We'll have to figure out a time and a space to do that. But I actually want to lay it over now because I do have a couple motions that I want us to go through quickly. We have Representative Munson here, and we've had him here 3 or 4 times before. Representative Munson, I just assume it would be fair to you to move you out. So the chair at this point lays over House File 3085. And the chair moves House File 1864, Representative Munson. You do have some amendments. So members, we should be able to do this pretty quickly. We heard the amendments in our evening hearing last week. And so we heard them and had conversation at that time. I do want to note for the record that House File 1864 as lifted off the table includes the amended language from our original hearing. And I believe that language had to do with fetal alcohol, adding that to that. There's no engrossment for that, members. It threw me for a bit because, you know, we laid the bill over. So obviously there's no other engrossment. But I just want the members to be aware of that, bringing the bill back up includes the amendment that we moved at that time. And so, members, I'm hoping we could do this with no testimony because we had the testimony the other evening. The chair will move the A2 amendment. These two amendments that are coming are amendments that are meant to limit the cost and the impact of this bill. And so with that, the chair moves the A2 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The chair moves the A3 amendment. Again, we discussed this, members, at the last hearing, had questions about it. And again, it's an amendment that attempts to limit the impact and the cost of the bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Munson, we may never see you again, and so maybe just a few words of something quickly, and then we'll act on your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the votes, and it's a good bill. Hope to see it on the floor.
Very well. The chair renews his motion that House File 1864, and Representative Munson, we're going to move this to Ways and Means. Is that your understanding?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I don't believe it was needed to be seen in judiciary, okay. So yeah, it can be moved to Ways and Means.
Very well. I just want to be clear that we're both on the same page with that. The chair renews the motion, House File 1864, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Mueller, you do have a testifier. This is House File, this one? Yes. 3555. Let's see if we can get this one done before we're supposed to recess. So Representative Mueller moves House File 3555 be referred to the Committee on Transportation, and I believe you have the chair of the DWI Task Force. Perhaps with you?
Yep, I have a couple witnesses. I'm just going to quick give an intro to this. We do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment. If we can, if you don't mind us getting the bill in shape.
Oh, very well. Representative Mueller moves the A1 amendment. This shapes the bill up the way you wish to have it before us. Very well. All in favor of that motion, please say aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 3555, as amended, is before us. Representative Mueller.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And in the interest of time, I'll be really brief. This is a DWI task force bill. There's a lot of collaboration for this bill. The task force recognizes that our roads are safer when offenders are on the Ignition Interlock program. As a prosecutor, I've handled criminal vehicular homicide cases. When I worked for a nonprofit for a couple of years, I helped work on a bill to change the loophole that let drivers who were guilty of hit and run escape liability. I shared office space with the Mothers Against Drunk Driving and came to know several people who lost loved ones to drunk driving. I would not have agreed to take on this bill if I did not believe that it enhanced public safety of our roads. You'll see in your packet, we have a number of support letters, so I'm not going to name all of those. I will also say that the County Attorneys Association Criminal Law Committee has voted to support the bill, but they have to go through their final board process, and it does have a hearing in the Senate next week. I've been honored to work with Representative Baker on this bill, and Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to just turn it over to him.
Very well. Representative Baker, welcome to the
committee. Mr. Chair and members, because of the shortness of our time, too, I had a testifier that was going to be here today to talk about what it's like to drive a car with a W plate. She was not able to be here because she has the regular flu. I wanted to make sure I said that, but she couldn't be here. I was going to drop a bill that really just got rid of the W plates, otherwise known as the whiskey plates, and because I learned that Representative Mueller had a actually more expansive bill, I thought this was a better way to relook at how we make sure our roads are safe. And I think over with technology, with the ignition interlock system, that has separated, in my mind, safety with driving privileges. And I think that looking at some things today, this is a very good kind of a reform way to look at how actually more people with ignition interlock can be on our roads. I am going to just kind of step back and say that this is, I think, a very good bill. I have worked with addiction on different levels around here, as most members know. I think putting a W plate on a car today, when there is already some ignition interlock system in the car, does give a lot of safety issues that we are all concerned about. And just the process that has gone on. So with new technology, I think this bill is, it's time to see the light of day for this. So I will step back, and because of time, I want to make sure we give our testifiers more time. But thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Baker, for your work on this and for working with Representative Mueller. Also, please come forward quickly. We're only going to do this for another 2 or 3 minutes, or you can come back this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Munson. I've been a probation agent with Brown County for 27 years, and for the past 16 years, I have been the lead agent for our department's intensive supervision program for repeat DWI offenders. I am also a chairperson of the ISP Collaborative, which is comprised of other probation agents throughout the state of Minnesota that also supervise high-risk repeat DWI offenders. We consider ourselves subject matter experts on the process because we've been dealing with it since it came into being approximately 9 years ago. Today, I specifically will address 2 points relative to the bill. First, I support the removal of the insurance certificate requirement because it is an unnecessary time constraint. As an agent working with the clients under perfect conditions, it takes 3 to 4 business days for an insurance certificate to come from the client's insurance company, not the agent they get the policy written through, but the company actual, to be processed and received and sent to DVS. The worst case in my experience has been more than 3 weeks for an individual's insurance certificate to be received and processed. My second point I'd like to make is to support the elimination of the limited license for interlock participants. The current limited license provision unnecessarily restricts clients who work rotating shifts. It also has no provision for a client to drive to and from job interviews if they're unemployed. Additionally, it does not allow for any participant to travel to or from medical appointments, either for themselves or dependent family members, such as children or elderly parents. In my opinion, the current limited license provision borders on discrimination of the elderly. A current participant who is of retirement age and either unemployed or no longer working because of retirement is only allowed to operate their motor vehicle with interlock to go see their probation agent, if they have one, and to drive to and from the interlock installation site for purposes of recalibration. Given the current overbearing restrictions of the limited license, it is not hard to understand why many clients are simply foregoing the installation of interlock and simply driving illegally. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Munson. And I have to say, you stumped me there for a second. I know I've driven through Brown County, and I just couldn't place it. So I Googled it up, and sure enough, you know, just west of Mankato, south of New Ulm, and on this side of Walnut Grove. So thank you for being with us here today. Please welcome to the committee, and very quickly, give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bernstein, and I'm the chair of Minnesota's DWI Task Force. We are not funded, not affiliated, not for profit. We are a volunteer organization made up of individuals, professionals who care about DWI legislation. The DWI Task Force proudly supports this bill. We want to thank Representatives Moeller and Baker and our co-authors for bringing the bill. I want to mention I have had conversations with Jeff Tate, and the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association has also voted to support this bill. I don't want to repeat what Mr. Munson said. This bill has a lot of aspects, but in the interest of brevity, I'm only going to discuss the whiskey plate provision. Simply put, whiskey plates serve no purpose. They do not protect public safety. Currently, Minnesota is only one of three states in the nation that employs the use of whiskey plates, the others being Ohio and Georgia in very limited circumstances. In 2003, the Minnesota Supreme Court issued a decision which held that law enforcement cannot pull over a vehicle on the basis of having a whiskey plate. And rather than quote Justice Gilbert, I'm going to paraphrase what he said in that opinion. Justice Gilbert of the Minnesota Supreme Court stated that the state has an important interest in protecting Minnesota's roads from drunk drivers. However, the subsequent issuance of special plates to allow the vehicle to be driven again does not necessarily further the state's interest in protecting the public, but may enable or facilitate the impaired driver's use of the same vehicle. These special plates do nothing to ensure that repeat offenders do not harm the motoring public by driving during their period of revocation. Rather, these special plates may actually provide a further opportunity for repeat drunken drivers to drive again and making available a property license vehicle. That came from Justice Gilbert of the Minnesota Supreme Court. For those who are unfamiliar, whiskey plates, I apologize for the size of this picture. This is an example of what they look like. They have a W in front of them, which is why they're referred to as whiskey plates. So what do these whiskey plates actually do? You look at the W, and that's all that they do. They do not protect public safety. As Justice Gilbert indicated, they do not stop a drunk driver from driving a vehicle impaired. Ignition interlock does. And so this bill promotes the use of ignition interlock, which then reduces recidivism. There are no statistics at all that indicate that whiskey plates reduce recidivism. So ignition interlock makes our roads safer. Whiskey plates do not. And for those reasons, this is a very important provision of this bill, and the DWI Task Force proudly supports it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I'm struck by just being a lawmaker and over time putting together things like technology, experience, listening to folks on the ground, and then adjusting our laws accordingly. And if this becomes law, then hopefully we've continued a high quality of tradition of making our laws that much more relevant and meaningful and effective in Minnesota. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, just a couple of things on this bill. I know we're running short, and I have other meetings I have to be at as well. I have a couple of issues with this. One is the removal of the insurance certificate. That certificate guarantees that the insurance company and the state can, and the person can provide absolute proof that he has insurance to drive his vehicle. Without that certificate, there's no way of documenting that he actually did buy the insurance, because I've seen plenty of falsified insurance certificates or insurance policy stuff in my stops, and I end up calling the insurance company. It's surprising how often they say, no, he doesn't have insurance with us. without a certified copy of it, the state can't prove that he actually has insurance, and they're giving him a license to drive. Now, unfortunately, with the whiskey plates, I have some issues with that. It's one way or the other. But it was a bad decision by the courts back in 2003. I was an officer then. In order to get a license plate, once you had multiple DWIs, you had to sign a thing that you agreed to be stopped at any time by law enforcement with those plates. The judge threw that out, even though that they signed the agreement. Part of the problem is now that the state has given them out like candy, and they're not restricted to the certain things they were originally done for. And I think there's certain times where the whiskey plates are proper, and we need to look just look and get them smaller. So with that, I understand the concept of this bill, but I do have some problems with it, especially when you're not requiring an insurance certificate. That helps make sure that the person has insurance, and without it, if they crash, all it's doing is increasing the cost of insurance for everybody else in the state because they have to have that no-fault insurance.
Mr. Bernstein, very quickly, I did note that you shared that the Minnesota Chiefs of Police are supportive of this bill.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Very well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, with respect to the insurance certificate, an individual does have to provide valid proof of insurance in order to enroll in Ignition Interlock. What the insurance certificate does is it requires them to prepay for a year's worth of insurance in advance and obtain a special certificate certified by the insurance company to provide. We feel that those steps are unnecessary. The goal is to have valid insurance, but the idea of prepaying for a year in advance and getting the special certificate is unnecessary unless you have prior insurance violations.
Representative Johnson, and then we're going to vote, members.
Chair Mariani, the testifier. I don't know how many times I've stopped people that bought 1 month worth of insurance, and especially when they're on the high risk. I've stopped the habitual drunk drivers that buy 1 month worth of insurance to get their vehicles insured so they can get the tabs. If there are multiple DUI drivers, they're in this program, pay a year's worth of insurance in it and prove that you have it. I'm tired of people like driving without insurance, crashing and injuring people and not having insurance. With that in there, I cannot support this bill.
Very well. Members, the chair renews his motion that House file, or rather, Representative Mueller, it's your motion. Representative Mueller renews her motion that House file 3555 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Members, I'm going to put us this committee into recess. Please recess at the call of the chair. Please watch your emails and/or phone calls. Feel free to check with my office. We'll let you know as soon as we secure a room and a good time for everyone. So until then, this committee stands in recess.